If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Welcome to Needle Exchange, the podcast that stitches together the vibrant world of embroidery and textile art. In this episode, I'm talking with Harriet Riddle, a UK-based artist whose free motion machine stitches capture the essence of people, places, and stories. In this episode, Harriet shares her journey from discovering her love for free motion embroidery to taking her sewing machine around the world. From bustling Indian markets to the peaceful woods of the UK, Harriet has stitched in some of the most unusual places. Along the way, she tells us how she innovates with techniques like slap applique and how she uses unconventional setups like her bicycle-powered sewing machine to bring her art to life. If you love hearing about the intersection of adventure and creativity, this episode is for you. And don't forget to check out episode 8 with Meredith Warno, who also uses a sewing machine to create stunning textile art. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Harriet's charismatic, talented, and we have a great chinwag. I will be back next week with the second part of our needle exchange. So until then, enjoy the show.
No, cute name though.
Yeah, where did it come? Where did you get the idea?
Well, Ben's middle name is Douglas, but that's not why. Like, I've always enjoyed the name Douglas. I went to school with a Douglas, and he was so cute.
And is he a Douglas, or would he become a Doug over time?
I think he'll be a Doug or a Dougie. He's currently a little Dougie,
but not a Hey Dougie. Or does he get that and not mind it?
Well, he loves Hey Dougie. Only just recently. I mean, we've been forcing it down his neck for years now. But
yeah. I always liked Hey Dougie from a design standpoint. I just always liked the character design and stuff. And the fact it was kind of based on like Flash animation. Like that was kind of when they first started doing it. They started it, I don't know, it's probably been 10 years now or something, but they did it in Flash animation. And then that got outdated, like the technology changed. So then they had to rebuild their whole system so it still looked like Flash animation.
Oh, right. I didn't know that.
But you see, I'm a pretty strong Bluey fan. Do you watch Bluey?
I mean, I've never felt so seen watching Bluey as a new parent.
What are your favourite episodes?
I mean, there's the one when Bluey's not crawling yet.
Baby race.
The baby race. And the mum's just, the poodle dog's obviously like succeeding in life. And then the poodle mum's just turns and looks at Bluey's mum and says, "You're doing a great job."
Honestly, swear to God. I'm in bits on that one. I swear to God. But that's why it's so good, isn't it? People don't really understand it unless they try it. But I was explaining to some friends of ours the other week who came round. They sort of like Bluey. They got a son called Remy who's about 4 and they weren't quite in the Bluey zone. But I was like, here's some episodes you got to watch. And I made them sit down and we watched Flat Pack, which is the one where they're building a swing, but it's also about evolution and it's about like
parents.
Yeah, and reaching back and touching like the hand on the Sistine Chapel and all that. So we watched that. I'm like, see, that was really nice, wasn't it? And then we watched Sleepy Time, which is my ultimate it's going to make me cry one, which is the one where Bingo's going to sleep and she's dreaming about space and her mum is the sun and she's like, "Remember, I'll always love you. no matter where I am. And I've got, you've got to find that one. It's a killer. It's a killer. So then I'm like literally just crying with Flora in front of me, wiping my eyes on the back of her t-shirt. And then we watched one that's come out quite recently, which is called Cricket, which is about Rusty the dog and how good he is at cricket and what a nice boy he is and all of that sort of stuff. And at the end, you're just like, he's such a nice boy. And I was literally just streaming with tears down my face because I hadn't watched them for a while. And then I watched three of my most potent ones back to back. It was like, whew, I was like, it's going to need a moment, guys.
Yeah.
But I think it's really healthy. Like these days, me and Mary, we watched the, you know, Paddy McGuinness did that thing for children in need where he cycled from like Wrexham to Glasgow on a chopper bike.
No.
Okay. But he did that and he raised a lot of money. And we watched a little documentary about that, where at the end of every day, he's like high-fiving all these school kids and people are telling him how much he's won. And he's in bits and me and Mary are all in bits. And we're like, this is healthy. I think this is good, you know?
It's funny what will trigger you at the end of the day, because sometimes it can be the minor thing.
Yeah.
Like, suddenly all this emotion's coming out. You're like, oh, this feels good.
Right. Oh, we watched RuPaul's Drag Race final last night as well. And that was another one where it's just like, have you ever watched Drag Race?
I've watched it once. I've not been a big fan.
They get to the final and they're just like, Kyron Thrax, what would you say to 4-year-old Kieran? And then they get the photo and they're always like, you're going to go through some stuff. You know, you're going to be challenged by stuff that will make you wonder if it's all. And we're just like, oh my God. Because it's like Bake Off, but it's about, you know, people's identity and them being their true selves and all that sort of stuff. And we're just like, and I just know I'll just look at Mary on the sofa because I can feel myself filling up and she'll be like exactly the same boat.
Beautiful.
Just like lean into it, really. So, but let's talk about podcasts. How was the Knitting and Stitching show then? You did London, Dublin and Harrogate, right?
London, Belfast and Harrogate.
Belfast, sorry. Yeah.
Yes, I did. It was full on. It was brilliant. Yeah, what a treat to be invited to all three, but exhausting. And had to leave my toddler for a week a time, which was tough. But yeah, really inspiring. Yeah, it was fun.
They're quite different shows, aren't they? The people. I did London, Dublin and Harrogate when it was Dublin 2013, 2012, something like that. And I just remember in Ireland, you just have the best conversations, which generally didn't have anything to do with needlework whatsoever.
Yeah, I fell in love with the Irish. I've got the bug. I think I need to go back. They were great. I was so busy. Mm. They're just up for the crack, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And Harrogate, again, slightly different audience. But then you're like, I was kind of blown away by your exhibition because obviously I've not seen you for a while. And obviously there's a lot of time when you just like Harriet does portraits. But then you had some amazing scenes and they were so vibrant with all the buildings and all the scapes. Would you like to explain your entire presentation?
Sure. So initially I wanted my artwork to be all about rewilding. So I did a exhibition earlier this year at NEP, which is an area of rewilding in Sussex.
Yes, of the book Wilding.
And yeah, Wilding by Isabella Tree.
Yeah.
And so for that exhibition, I created two chairs and about ragwort and thistles.
Right.
And the sort of celebrating these underdogs of the ecosystem. And the yellow one was called Get Comfortable and the little red one was Nature Knows. And fortunately, they both sold at NEP, which was great. But when you're a mother with little time, it's and you've got a 9 by 7 meter space to fill at Knitting and Stitching, it's sort of looping in the head.
Yeah.
In my head. So anyway, they went. So I thought I'd continue on with this theme. And I was doing work in the woods, but I wanted to go bigger. So my most newest piece is quite different to the rest of my pieces, where I've done a ink drawing in the woods on with black ink on white paper over two pieces of paper. This is sort of Hockney inspired.
Mm-hmm.
And then I digitalized those, made them huge, and then got them laser cut out of black felt.
Wow.
And then sort of figured out how to stitch that down with colors behind the black felt drawing. And I made two huge pieces that sit one on top of the other for the show. And that was really fun. I really enjoyed that, just to try something new. And
Was it like that? Was it like, you had a step, like you know you drew your picture, and then you're like, what can I do with this? And then an idea came, and then like did you see the end product at the start, or did you, like you say, laser cutting felt and all of that sort of stuff? Were you just like, I don't know, let's just try laser cutting some felt?
Well, I because using a sewing machine, like, to go big anyway is challenging because you've got the arm of the machine, but I'm also very limited. My line work is sort of my strong point, my drawing is through the machine, so. And the thread is just one size. Whereas if you use a piece of charcoal or a pen, you can kind of easily mark make with different thicknesses.
Mm.
But I don't, it's much harder to do that with the sewing machine.
Mm.
So, and to go big, you obviously want, I felt like I wanted my line to go, to kind of match the scale. So that's why I thought, let's try laser cutting black felt.
Yeah, I love it.
To kind of dense out my line work. So that was kind of like the elephant in the room in amongst the other work, because it was quite different. And I'd made a chair, another chair, which is like sit back, and I really am loving the upholstery. And I have a friend, a very talented upholsterer, who's done two of my chairs, Amy Payton. So I wanted a chair in the show. So I got like a woodland chair done. But then I was running out of time, and I had this residency in the summer in Taiwan.
Of course.
Yeah. And they wanted me to document the rehearsals of a religious procession.
Right.
And I was really hoping that this religion or the God they were celebrating would be something to do with nature, so I could tie it into the show, but it was all about business and money.
Okay, right.
This guy, he's called Lord Guan.
Is he a modern god, by any chance?
Yeah, right. He's fairly modern in terms of the godscape.
Yeah.
But he was a real man, and he succeeded in everything. He was very good at fighting. He was very smart at school, and he did very well in business. So people really highly revere him, because if they pray to him, then it brings good fortune on them. But there was no real link to nature. I made quite a few pieces there, and I was running out of time, so I had to change my exhibition. I called it A Sense of Place.
Yeah, very good. Good covering, yeah.
I thought that could encompass
anything.
Anything. And I guess for me, my work is about capturing a sense of place and a time and a moment, and I'm really sitting in it. And so my other pieces, I take my sewing machine out, like the ones in Taiwan, and I sit and illustrate what I see and hear there and then. So during the rehearsals, they were all in the nighttime, because everyone goes to work in the day and then they get together, and they wear these big puppet suits. And I got to get in one of them and practice swinging my arms. Quite enjoyed that. And stitch that as I see it. So I made like a 3 meter long piece, just which started off quite neat. But then I realized we just need to throw stitches down. So I was just like trying to capture everyone and anyone. And they love to see that sort of the work come alive in front of them, and see themselves immortalized in thread. So, and then I did a piece kind of reflecting on my memories of those night practices. And I had this one experience there where, so they let me play around with the puppets, but they had the dragon dance. And I was really excited to try this, because it's like, you might remember from Blue Peter, there's like a long line of people and they're all holding a part of the dragon, and someone's at the front.
Yeah.
Like formations, and run around in sort of figures of eight and stuff, and it goes up and down and up and down. And I used to be a hula hooper, and I used to be in a hoop troupe. And
okay.
We do sort of these formations and funny kind of hula hoop choreographs. So in me, I was so excited to have a go at this dragon dance, but they wouldn't let me have a go because I'm a woman. And Taiwan is... it's a very liberal place, I've got to say that. Like, I felt so safe as a woman. It didn't strike me as like huge inequalities between men and women and unlike other countries I've been to. But I was so shocked that I wasn't allowed to play with the dragon because I'm a woman. And it was an old rule within their religion. But no one else seemed to really care. The women didn't care. I felt like I cared for everyone there. Like, they're just so used to... it's just not what they do.
You're like the emperor's new clothing, aren't you? You're like, there's something wrong here. And they're like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. So I left feeling like kind of sad about that. I asked like why, and it's all down to women having periods. And like that makes us dirty people, apparently, in old Taoism religion, right, which of course is ridiculous. Mm. And I was like, what? But we make children. We make the future. How is that dirty? But so then I stitched this temple god who guards the door. She's a woman within the temple. But I made her pregnant and a warrior, because none of the women are like depicted as these fighters. And then like, and I put some scales in, which later looks like such a Western symbol, having like
like justice and liberty. Yes. Right? Yeah.
So it looks really weird, actually, when I later look at it, think it is out of place. But I suppose that's what it's meant to be. It's my Western sort of like vision, I suppose, wanting like equality and justice.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like it's a little bit of politics that you've put in there without realizing, but it's a reflection of what you just said. Like the imbalance. Yeah.
Yeah, I just felt like this isn't fair. Mm. I later heard that the women can dance with the phoenix. And I thought, that's cool. But there wasn't any phoenix dancers involved. So I thought maybe I'll go back and start a phoenix troupe. But maybe I should just look after my son and it'll be okay.
You put that in the someday maybe list, I think, is what, isn't it? Just, you know, if I run out of anything to do, I'll go back to Taiwan.
Yeah. So that was my Taiwan work. Then I had a Glastonbury piece I did this summer.
Wilderness site?
No. Green Kids in Glastonbury.
Yeah, go on. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've done Glastonbury for many years. That's actually where I met my partner. So, and a lot of my sort of friend family.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a fond place in my heart is Glastonbury. But the areas I work, there's no electricity. So it was actually Glastonbury that inspired me to start using a bicycle to power my sewing machine.
Mm, yeah.
And this year I was in the kids' field, so the green kids' field, and under this amazing 500-year-old oak, and the children were all jumping on the bike and whizzing me up some electricity, and then I was sort of stitching what I could see under this oak over the 5 days. And that was great because, I mean, child labour, one, is fantastic when it's free.
Contextually, child labour is fantastic.
Yeah, so I've got that piece was in there. And then I had my biggest artwork was this railway scene, train station, which I think I've spent weeks and weeks and weeks on. And that got a lot of love, just a sort of panoramic view of my local train station, which I stitched just after the pandemic was sort of breaking, and it was this idea of getting back into travel again.
There's something about that, though. There was a real, like, the industry of it, again, being quite different to the nature and all of those kind of things. I think sometimes that's a good, I was going to say like a palate cleansing sorbet, but it's not. But, you know, you just get those contrasts, don't you, between your different scenes. So in a way, there's a familiarity to that that offsets maybe the unfamiliarity of like the dragon celebration kind of stuff.
True. Yeah. And I wonder how it felt. Yeah. Like how well it translates, the Taiwan work for an audience. Because for me, it was just bonkers. Like, I mean, it was interesting because I got to, because I was doing the rehearsals, it was like this weird slow drum roll to the actual event, which was 2 days right at the end of the residency. So then to suddenly see it all come together was just utterly overwhelming, because it was just so loud and just quite intense. So I didn't really know what to expect, but to like capture that all into my work. Well, a lot of it was just the rehearsal, so the actual thing has kind of got a bit lost, I suppose. But very interesting to capture that. But yeah, you're right, the sort of contrast is probably quite good for people.
There's other artists. Like, there's an artist called Gillian Bates who I've often admired. Similar, machine embroidered, but she does these little snapshots of like the English vernacular. She lived in Eastbourne. I think she still lives there. So there's lots of seaside scenes, but not like your cliche ones, more like these little moments that people see, or maybe a bowling green, or maybe someone slightly being attacked by a seagull. But those moments that are captured, the same with your work, you know, they've got a value, they've got an importance. And so the reason, like, it's not to worry about what people think about what you've captured, it's for people to be amazed that you've captured it and for it to be sufficiently valuable to merit being captured in the first place. Does that make sense?
Yeah, true. It's sort of shining a light on the mundane, or sort of finding art in the everyday.
With any of these documentary things, you know, needlework takes time. And so if people are going to spend time making a thing, then it's got to be worth making. Now, yours is quicker than the average. I mean, yours is crazy quick because of your mad skills. But it's like anybody that makes anything, if they're going to go, I'm going to immortalize this, it's got to be worth immortalizing it. And what I love is when people do it. We had the Mr. X Stitch Needlework Prize, and one of the second place winners, one of her pieces was a guy tasting the food he was making in a restaurant. You know, those little moments are beautiful. You know, I can think of a few other people in my head who've just got like captured. Oh God, I'm just rubbish with names at the moment.
I'm just going to write down Gillian Bates because I need to remember her name. I do recognise her name. I need to look up her work.
I've got a picture of hers in our bathroom because she's like done some shots of Brighton, which is where my grandparents grew up and stuff. And
nice.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably getting damp and mouldy over time. Don't put it in your bathroom. But
some originals.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, any of these moments, these little bits of the vernacular, because we always like document the big things, but the big things aren't real life in a way. They're like, you know, covered by loads of people's opinions and this and that and the other. Where the fact that you've got like somebody being attacked by a seagull who's stealing a chip, or some of the work that you've done, or just a railway station, you know, on an average day. Rosie James and her machine embroidered pieces of people waiting. It's waiting around.
I love her work, yeah.
Yeah, but it's that same thing, isn't it? There's a real niceness in capturing it. I think I'm going on one now, you can tell. Our photographing culture with our phones means that we've devalued in some ways the importance of taking photos, because we can take 100 in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
So it's almost like what you're doing, that kind of documentary increases in value because you can't bang out 100 shots of yours in a heartbeat.
No, of course not. Yeah, it's hard. Textiles is just, it takes time, doesn't it? I mean, I realized that since having a child, I'm like, I must make my work faster. I must make more work faster. And it doesn't work like that. You can't make your work faster. And in fact, maybe you need to take slower, and I want to go bigger and better. And actually that means a lot more time. And within that becomes more risk as well. Cause like if you don't sell it, it becomes, you've got to sort of weigh up your time and then the like practicality of selling it, and because you are running a business, so it's very difficult.
It's weird, isn't it?
Yeah, how you value it all.
I think the child thing, suddenly you just go, okay, first of all, I'm finite. Second of all, this person appears to be more important than me 5 minutes into the world. But also you just feel like you can't spend your time just dicking around, you know? You don't want to waste time. But I think the interesting thing, or I would push back against what you said there, is I don't think you need to make more work faster. Maybe you need to like put your prices up or something to balance it out. But I think like making more work, like we just put pressure under ourselves. I've done it loads of times where I'm like, I need to do this thing. And I'm the only person telling myself that thing has to be done. Whereas if you're able to relax a little into it, maybe the zen of the universe kind of just keeps things going quite happily for you. I think I'm trying to get you to cut yourself a little bit of slack.
Thanks, Jamie. Yeah,
It's probably impossible. Somehow, well, so there's two launching points here. I wanted to find out all about how Harriet became Harriet Riddle Stitch in Stitch U, because I feel like I was looking back through your Instagram, and even back in 2011, your early pieces have that kind of like, I think they just look like they were drawings, but you're still just drawing without taking your pen off the page. That just seems to have been a thing. I mean, was that when you started Instagram, were you already doing stuff on a sewing machine and already exploring that form of illustration?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 2011. All those years ago.
Take me back to the start.
Okay, to the start. I went to university in Hertfordshire. Mm-hmm. And I studied a mixed media art degree called Contemporary Applied Art, because I wanted to just play around with different mediums and learn techniques. I loved my art foundation, so I just kind of wanted to continue playing and exploring. And this course was fantastic with that, because every week we'd learn a different technique. Turns out I'm not very good at following rules. And and a lot of crafting techniques, there are a lot of rules within them. Right. So everyone else would make lovely things, and I would kind of end up boiling a plastic bag and stretching it across something, and it would just look disgusting and awful, and felt like I was sort of trying and failing at everything. But I loved life drawing.
Right.
And I would go to life drawing in the evenings, and I went to an exhibition called Lost in Lace in Birmingham.
Right.
It was a fantastic exhibition looking at kind of contemporary ways that lace could be.
Mm.
And that brought me back to the sewing machine. So I say back because my gran taught me free motion embroidery when I was about 10.
Wow.
Cool. And my mum taught me how to use a machine when I was about 5. So wow. I was always kind of a textile girl.
Mm.
But of course, it's like an indoor subject. And I always loved to be outdoors, which is why I was sort of weaving willow and making weird sculptures outside. Thank God I found the stitching. And so I started to draw with a sewing machine, writing indoors, outdoors in dissolvable fabric to try and make a sort of lace. But that I'd wash it away and it became a big bundle of thread. And
some engineering needed.
Yeah. So then I started doodling on some canvas, what I could see out the window. And my life drawing tutor saw these doodles. And then when I was in his class drawing the naked models, I started to draw a bit like stitching extra. So it was his idea to bring a sewing machine into a life drawing class. And so I did. And I don't know, have you tried life drawing?
No.
So it's there's a naked person in the middle of the room and everyone takes it very seriously.
I was going to say, it seems like the sort of thing where a machine going at it probably is a bit offering.
That's it. Everyone's silent.
Yeah.
Concentrating very hard. There's me and my machine going. So, which was very embarrassing. But fortunately, my tutor was very supportive and made me feel very welcome. Unlike some other classes since leaving university. But anyway, but this was a eureka moment. Naturally, I never stitched over a sketch. I just went straight in, and that's always been my way. And because of the way the thread works, it's like drawing without lifting your pen up from the paper. It was just easier and quicker for me to not cut and move the thread. So that really developed a style. And I found immediately a narrative would come out in my drawings and a sort of sense of humor as well. So I stitched a pregnant woman and I put her face in her tummy and I wrote like mother, like daughter. And then like around her tummy wrote like best womb in the house and silly things.
Yeah, yeah.
So after the life drawing room, I thought, where do I go next? And took it to the laundrette on campus.
Okay.
I really loved the laundrette. I've always loved washing my clothes. I don't know if it's a textile thing, you know, just turning dirty clothes nice and clean.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I always left the student laundrette richer. People would just leave their pound coins in the machine.
Right, that's what it is. Yeah, good job.
So I stitched the students doing their laundry and then wrote like messy buggers as the janitors sweeping up after them. And then the head of school found me in the corridor stitching the vending machine. And she was like, have you nowhere better to work? And I said, well, I'm stitching the vending machine. And I just really liked that the act of using a sewing machine got under her skin a little bit.
Right.
The cheeky side of me.
Yeah.
So then I realized I just needed a table and a chair and a plug socket. So I was constantly looking for plug sockets because that's how you make the sewing machine work. And took my machine to cafes and pubs on the train.
On the train. I bet that got some looks in.
Well, I was on a busy train on the way to Bristol and the woman in front of me was quite disgruntled because I kept using her foot as the foot pedal.
Right.
So I was feeling quite shy and started to stitch the bags up in the locker, but she totally got the measure of me and got her pen and paper out and started to sketch me.
Okay.
Then I started to stitch her.
You're like and we had Julian sort of, banjos all of a sudden.
Yeah, the stitch sketch off. That was sort of, everyone else was wondering what is going on. But she forgave me for stepping on our feet and we swapped our drawings. But so my degree show was just a series of like pub scenes and bookies and cafes. And then I did New Designers as a graduate show and I had my work up in the middle of the show because I entered an absolute vodka bottle competition. So I ended up stitching this 10-foot vodka bottle randomly. And I met a woman there who offered me a job as an in-house artist for a company called Pentland.
Right.
And they designed shoes. So I worked with them for 6 months making artwork for their offices and stitching portraits of the heads of departments. I was quite lucky, really. I mean, I felt like the luckiest girl alive.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing.
And then I went self-employed as in situ.
Mm-hmm.
In situ. Sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Got it?
Even better. Yeah.
And started stitching portraits at Greenwich Market. So I'd rock up there at 8 a.m. They were very kind to me because I think I was doing something a bit different. They'd always gave me a spot right in the middle of the market. They never charged me my 50 quid for a table. And I started stitching portraits 15 minutes for £15 for the tourists. And
A Bentley.
Not quite. Bought a ticket to India.
Yeah, I was going to say 2014. So you graduate in 2012. 2014, yeah. You're in India doing it.
Yeah, yeah. So I spent a year in London at a studio in Clapham making my business go, and then had enough money to go to India. And I realized I could use motorcycle batteries and an inverter and bring my own table and chair. And then I was totally free. I didn't have to ask permission to stitch. I could stitch where I wanted. So off I went to India, much to my parents' dismay. I found a Punjabi family to live with in Delhi. I spent 6 weeks with them, and they sort of taught me the ropes of India. And my first stitch was in a park that looked very much like a park you'd find in England, because I was a bit intimidated by the rest of the city.
Right.
It was so crazy. And I met a fashion designer called Anit Arora. Her label's called Perro, P-E-R-O. Beautiful clothes, lovely, lovely stuff. And she asked me if I could document all the makers within her fashion, like her workshop. So I stitched her embroiderers and her dyers and her weavers, and tried to incorporate the textiles that they were using and making within the work as well. And she had like this amazing collection of all her like past fabrics, and we'd walk into this Aladdin's cave and she'd let me pick out all these fabrics, and oh, it was the best.
Mm.
And then I was on her stand at Indian Delhi Fashion Week, and I met this documentary maker, filmmaker, and she filmed me doing one of my stitches out in the street in Delhi, which is on YouTube. It's called Sewing Stories. And that's just a lovely, I was so lucky. She's called Teresa Mahoney, the filmmaker, and she made this beautiful 5-minute movie of me interacting and stitching a man who was embroidering saris in the market. I'm lucky to have that, because a lot of the interactions that happen while I work are so lovely and really are a big part of why I do what I do out on the street. But they often get lost because I don't have wonderful filmmakers following me around.
Yeah.
So I was pleased to get that record. So after that first trip to India, I made a book about it, which a little book with all my stories and stitches and sketches. And
you're kind of journaling as you go as well.
Yeah. Right. But back then, that was sort of, I was on Tumblr. That was the
nice
Tumblr blog days.
I think that's still a thing, isn't it, Tumblr?
Is it?
I think maybe, yeah.
Okay,
I mean,
cool.
Who knows? You know.
I mean, I've got archives and archives on there.
Might be good to go and find out. You'll be like, wow, it's not just kittens and porn on there anymore. It's quite different.
Yeah, so... And that was like really nice to make a record. I should make another book, because that was 10 years ago, 2014.
Mm.
And a man in Canada saw this book and asked if I wanted to cycle across India with him with my sewing machine. So, of course.
The best conversations with people, don't you? Hi, would you like to go on an epic adventure around the world? Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, that was a really cool experience. Just 2 weeks, but a lot of cycling.
Mm-hmm.
I had my sewing machine in the back of my bag, and I documented all the different temples and different towns, and rocking up into these little sleepy villages on my own and setting up my machine. It is a bit intimidating. You don't know what's going to happen, and the sort of dogs sort of sniffing you out, but it's never been terrible.
Is there something there about the fact that you're using a sewing machine and there's a ubiquity about them? Like anybody in the world kind of knows what a sewing machine is and kind of knows what a sewing machine does. Does that like give you a passport to entry almost?
I think you're right. It's such a sort of beloved tool. It's a very familiar tool. I think if I stood with an easel, and a paintbrush, there's something a bit different. It's a bit more of a barrier. It's a little bit more, I don't know. It's
got class involved in it. The minute, like that's the problem with embroidery, but in this case, it's the savior of it, isn't it? Is that it's classless.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, I've never thought about it like that. But yeah, and I suppose it is that familiarity. And also, I think people have their expectations are not where, like when they come and see what you're up to, it's just never what they'd expect.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. That's the beauty of you, though, isn't it? Is the fact that you're A, using a sewing machine in an unexpected place, and then B, making a thing that people can watch be created, and then it just so happens you're flipping awesome at this. So, you know, whatever it is, whether it's a portrait or something like that, it's immediately going to bring joy to people's lives. Like it's a real trifecta, that.
Yeah, I think that's the key. Like, I love the joy, and I am kind of documenting society, but I think the way I see the world, I'm very aware of like the audience I'm in, and I always feel a guest in the place that I'm in. So I think I'm quite delicate and careful with, like, I never want to take the piss out of someone's home, or, you know, like, I don't quite get my teeth into things aggressively. That's not really my style anyway. I don't see the world like that. Like, compared to, say, Grayson Perry's tapestries, you know, he can kind of take the piss a little bit out of people's, at the different classes, if you think about his.
You're trying to hold on to some innocence, perhaps.
I suppose so, yeah. And like, and I don't think, sometimes I'm like, is that because I'm not brave enough to like, but I think it is. I just don't.
From the get-go, you've said you've always had playfulness in your work. And I think some people, I think that has a lot of value, particularly in the world we live in now. People who just do things because it's a nice thing to do. People who do things because they just want to show how lovely the world is. There's nothing wrong with that. And it's sad that it feels like there's something wrong with that.
Yeah, I guess so. Like, you feel like as an artist, you need to like bring up your demons and like...
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
Bring up everyone else's demons with it. But I guess I consciously choose not to. And maybe I should test myself and try and sit in that space. But doesn't come very naturally. I think I'd much rather make people happy and myself with it. But
I honestly, like, I'm an old curmudgeon, and I think making people happy is like literally the best thing you can do. And I think that when you become a parent as well, I think that starts to happen, because you see the world, you want the world to be a happy place for your kids. So you don't want to walk down the river. Like, I just took the Annie and our dog for a walk down the brook before coming here. I didn't want to go, oh, look, the river's full of crap or whatever. You just like, look how fast it's flowing, you know, and that's the difference. But I also think there's something about like being a documentary artist, you know, you document people with your portraits, you know, and you document places. Like you say, you're not putting your opinion on it. It's kind of like there's an aloofness. But so the thing is, though, so you went to India. As far as I can tell, looking at your Instagram, you've pretty much travelled everywhere around the world now doing this.
Not quite, but hopefully by the time I'm old and frail, I would have.
Where have you been?
India 6 times. Love India. Been to Kenya 3 times, South Africa, Taiwan a few times. Vietnam, Canada, America, France, Switzerland, Sweden.
Like, it's pretty incredible to have been able to do that, and to, like, I'm interested to know how you've been able to, like, afford it, which sounds like it's a crap question, you know, but somehow you've managed to make a business model that means that you've been paid in some form or other to do all of this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. That's really smart. How have you managed to do that?
I guess my number one key tip is I've never lived in a traditional house. Like, I have never, since being a actual grown-up, after graduating, I've always lived in unusual accommodation.
No, I'm just gonna, just for a second, you know, like before we started this conversation, you were like, I'm trying to think of something interesting to say about myself. I'm just writing that down. What have you lived on a narrowboat? That's what seems to spring to mind.
No, never lived in a narrowboat. So I lived in a nursing home, like a, not a nursing home anymore.
Okay.
I worked in a nursing home for 4 years while I was studying. And but then when I left that, I then learnt to live in a nursing home as a guardian, this guardianship.
Okay, yeah.
So like there's a middleman who's doing really well because the property owners pay them to protect their property. And then they get tenants who pay them to live there. So, I mean, this business model is great for the
people. Yeah. I'm surprised you haven't started doing that, to be honest.
So I lived in a nursing home. Then I lived in an old school in Peckham. Had an amazing big classroom. And I shared it with a friend, very good friend of mine, who I grew up with. And then, then I was like on the road a lot, especially in my mid-20s. I would just travel. I'd come back, I'd like land at my parents' door. I'd do the summer of festivals and shows, make enough money doing my portraits. And then I'd go again. And then I lived in a shed in London.
£5,000 a month.
Yeah, now I live in the woods.
Okay. In a bivouac? Yeah. In a cabin?
A little cabin we built, me and my partner built. He does the building side of things. I'm on electrics and plumbing.
I was going to say, in home furnishings.
Yeah, so we don't have any stopcocks, actually, because our loo is a compost loo. Mm-hmm. And we're totally off grid, so I'm on a... I don't have a fridge 6 months of the year.
Okay.
Yeah. So you sort of strip yourself of what some people might say are luxuries, but it kind of gives you a lot more freedom, which in my head just balances out in so much more of a better way. Yeah. But now I have a child and... overhead to like whether you like them, they just start mounting up, don't they? So
yeah, you need to build a garage in the woods, and you may need to put a loft in the cabin, and then you'll just fill that with crap and you won't understand how it's happened.
Yeah. That's it. I mean, as an artist, that's what we do, isn't it? Just we fill space.
Yeah, we do.
Give us a space, we'll fill it.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NWDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needleexchange. See you next time.